Now, comedian Louis C.K. acknowledged today that the sexual misconduct allegations against him are true. This next segment will have some sensitive content. We advise listener discretion.
The comedian is known for cracking jokes about masturbation in his acts. Here's a clip.
That's not usually my problem. These days, my problem is very simple. It's trying to find a place in my house where I can masturbate without somebody bothering me. And that's really difficult.
Yesterday, the New York Times reported that five women said those jokes are connected to his real-life behavior. CK had either masturbated in front of them, asked to do so, or did it when they spoke on the phone.
CK is one of the most popular comedians today. He's sold out Madison Square Garden 8 times, and he's one of several high-profile men in Hollywood, the media, and in politics to be the subject of sexual misconduct, harassment, or assault accusations.
As more reports come forward, it has some hoping that a cultural shift is taking place, changing the way we think about perpetrators and victims.
Jennifer Drobeck is a professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
I'm honored to be here.
Well, so many accusations going on here and stories and reports. Are we at a turning point now where we're going to change the way we think about the victims and their perpetrators?
Yes, I think we already have changed the way we view victims, number one. I think rather than viewing these women and sometimes men as complainers or as troublemakers, or as sometimes just flat-out liars, we are now recognizing that these are human beings deserving of compassion and vindication. As for the perpetrators, I think we now understand that there are really three types. There are what I call the clueless, what I call the careless, and really corrupt predators. I think we do understand better now.
It seems like a lot of the stories we're hearing fit into that last category, in some ways corrupt predators, because again and again, it's not something that someone blundered into once, whether we're looking at reports from the sports world or academia or the media. It's people who did roughly the same thing again and again with the plan, knowing that they were going to get away with it.
Right. These people know what they're doing is wrong. They don't care. And they derive a sense of empowerment and a feel for their own power when they do this to other people.
And a word we've used a lot talking about these cases is high profile. These are ones that we're going to hear reported on in the media when they come out. It makes me wonder what's on the rest of the iceberg, the people who work at restaurants or other low-income jobs who rely on maybe that paycheck to buy food or pay the rent next week and can't risk losing that job.
Right. And I worked prosecuting civilly these cases for about 10 years, and I've seen a lot of different kinds of behavior. It runs the gamut, and we all need to understand that there are different gradations of sexual harassment, everything from the gross elevator eyes to the inappropriate comments of the coffee maker to the very egregious violent behavior, rape, even just outright violence against women that may not take a sexual form but is sex-based, or that's engaged in because these men are now having lesbians in the workplace. So you see the whole range, and it's important for people to understand that just because a behavior isn't severe doesn't mean it's not harassment. It may not be actionable, but still may constitute sexual harassment. And in order for it to be actionable, it has to be severe or pervasive. And frequency is going to be inversely related to severity. So if it's a really serious incident, such as one of the types that we've heard about in the media recently, there only has to be one incident of that for there to be potentially a termination and for it to constitute actionable harassment.
What can people at the top in a business or other organization do to A, prevent this, and B, create a culture where the victims feel comfortable as possible coming forward to talk about it?
They have to do more than simply say, we take sexual harassment very seriously. that's not enough. So what they need to do is take action. They need to investigate, and thoroughly. They need to make sure that the environment is one in which any trainings that occur, occur with all of the employees, including the top executives. We've heard reports recently that trainings may not be successful. And in my experience, when someone who's clueless is educated, he's typically remorseful and wants to make amends. But when key executives take the attitude that this is a waste of time or that they don't need to have this, you can imagine the eye rolling that would go on. That's when the message doesn't get out, and it actually sends the opposite message, that this type of behavior will be condoned. And so it makes the workplace less respectful and decreases equal opportunity. And that's really problematic for the employers themselves and everyone, because if you don't have a safe and respectful work environment, you're not going to be highly productive. And so we need to see cultural change, and we need these executives to take this seriously. I'm thinking also of the lawmakers that we have in state houses and in Congress. The secrecy and the good old boy mentality, which continues to exist, needs to change.
We're talking to Jennifer Drobak from Indiana University, looking at sexual harassment, sexual assaults in workplaces in just about every walk of life, reports coming out these days. Jennifer, it seems like a lot of these stories, people have known. There's a culture of secrecy around this, and there's the idea that this person is one of our most productive engineers, best salespeople, the producer with a golden touch, the candidate we need to win to get the majority. There's a disincentive to take on that person. How do you make the case to an organization that they need to do that?
Well, it's a hard sell if there are no consequences. So if executives and lawmakers and rainmakers can continue to operate without consequences, then they will. So it's incumbent on all of us to do what we can to bring sunlight to this behavior. And so hats off to those women who have finally been able to come forward and say the emperor has no clothes, literally, or to call out this illegal and perhaps criminal behavior. But I think we need to look at, take a closer look at some of the particulars which enable these men to engage the way they have. And that goes to confidentiality provisions in settlement agreements, gag orders. It also goes to protocols that require that a complainant never discuss the incidents again, that they do not disparage the company in any way. And this allows predators to camouflage their behavior, and it allows companies to keep on a rainmaker or someone who's profitable to the company. And I think we need to call that out for what it is. It's pandering. It's basically sacrificing women for the profits of the company. They're retaining a valuable employee, whether he be someone who's a high-profile media executive or a filmmaker or a politician, but you name it. And these people are kept on. They're given renewed contracts, and it's the women around them who are suffering. And in other contexts, we'd call this pandering, and I think we should do it at the polite society level where it's occurring now.
A response we've seen in the past, we're seeing now, often from men, is, well, this couldn't be that big a deal. Why did it take the alleged victim in this case so long to come forward with this? Can you talk, Jennifer, about some of the obstacles that would prevent someone from reporting harassment or even sexual assault?
That's a great question. Some of the problems are best exemplified by recent events involving the President of the United States. This is a man who identified himself in a recorded interview as a grabber, someone who engages in illegal and possibly criminal conduct. And yet we voted him into office. Then the women came forward and said, yes, he did this to me. And what did he do? He called them all liars, which only confirms the fear by many women that they won't be believed. In essence, these women were not believed. And then what did he do? He threatened to sue them all. In other circles, that would be called retaliatory behavior. And that conduct confirms a second fear that women have, is that they will suffer negative consequences if they do come forward. Now, when the most powerful man in the world is able to do that and still operate as the president of the United States, then I think we have to stop wondering why women may not come forward. It's very difficult. I've heard men, even at a conference I was at this week, talk about how, well, there are all these false complaints, and I'm looking at this. Are there false complaints? Yes, they do occur. However, it is so difficult for a woman to come forward and publicly discuss the intimate abuse of her person and her space that there are very few false complaints compared to the number of true complaints that there are. And so I think that we need to vindicate these women. And I think that Louis C.K. did the right thing in doing exactly that. He said it was true. That's part of what needs to happen. Obviously, much more needs to happen. But the coming forward and the recognizing that this isn't just something that is done easily, that this involves shame. Now, that could lead us to an entirely different conversation about the way we deal with sexuality in our culture. If we could talk about it more honestly as a natural part of human functioning and human nature, then there might not be the shame about it. But this is because we have this shame, these men are able to abuse sexuality in order to empower themselves.
Jennifer Drobak is with us. She's a professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment. We're looking at the latest string of revelations about sexual harassment, misconduct, and more by a number of high-profile men.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you believe people are starting to take sexual harassment, assault, and misconduct allegations more seriously? Do you think we're at a turning point? And where do you think we should go from here? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Jennifer Drobak. She's a professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment. We're looking at the latest high-profile sexual assault, harassment, and misconduct allegations and whether we're at a turning point.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the allegations against people in Hollywood, the media, and in politics? Do you think that there's a shift in how the public is viewing victims and perpetrators? And what changes would you like to see in workplace policy or in the law? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
And Jennifer, we're seeing more and more women come forward, and there was this Me Too hashtag on social media inviting women to come out and share their stories. Is that something that you think makes a difference?
Yes, it does. Specifically, I actually think it created part of the environment that has prompted this turning point, as you've called it. When you have the high-profile cases of Roger Ailes, Bill Cosby, our own president, and then you get the hashtag MeToo campaign, that really established for many people just how pervasive this is. And this is not something that happens only with high-profile people, or this happens all over, not just in Silicon Valley and Hollywood and Washington, D.C., but in our own state houses everywhere, in our corporations, in our schools. And so when people realize that it's this pervasive, then they really begin to develop an understanding and a compassion, and it allows more women to discuss more freely what's happened to them. I just hope it leads to some changes in the law and some changes in workplace policies.
I want to bring in our callers now. Alex is on the line in Delavan. Alex, hi.
Hi. Your guest was previously speaking about President Trump and how he has been known as a grabber, and I unfortunately have been grabbed 4 times. After those comments came out, I started thinking about it, and you know, I realized that it's been that many. Fortunately, that was a long time ago when I was quite young in my teens, and I just wondered how we can initiate the conversation for young girls and women. I think it's even more difficult for younger people to come forward because the fear of persecution from peers in school is so great. As adults in the workplace, we might be a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more confident coming forward, but young girls, definitely not so much.
Alex, thanks for that call. I'm sorry that happened to you. Jennifer, opening the conversation with girls and young women, and then how about boys and young men, too?
Right. Well, I will actually say that I've written an entire book on the topic of the sexual harassment of teenagers, and it's called Sexual Exploitation of Teenagers. And I talk about not only how teenagers can be abused by adults in positions of authority, but I also talk about how the law should change to empower teens to come forward. So whether it be talking to a school counselor, to a parent, to another adult authority who has a sympathetic ear, I think teens need to understand that there is someone out there to whom they can complain, and they need to. There's help for them out there, and it's incumbent upon those of us who are adults in teens' lives to let them know that we're available for them and that we're available to talk if they ever need help. And obviously, this is not just for girls. Boys can be sexually harassed also, and it's much more common for males to be sexually harassed in school than in the workplace. And so I also talk about that in the book because men and boys faced different kinds of social stereotyping and stigma about coming forward, and sometimes it's difficult for them, too. So we need to broaden the conversation and make sure that all of our children feel empowered, respected, and supported.
Alex, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Helen in Rochester, Minnesota. Helen, hi.
Hi. My concern or my thought is that so much of the advertising, especially on sports events and so on, directed towards young men in their 20s and 30s or even their late teens, and we see this is kind of the thing that you're supposed to do. You know, you leer at young women, you are just the general attitude of our advertising. Is this not contributing to the whole culture that our kids, and again, it's on the sports events, they're watching these ads and it's cute and funny, and yet it's really not at all acceptable.
Helen, I want to jump in because we're getting short on time, but Helen, bring up ads and a lot of other pop culture too, Jennifer.
Right. Helen's absolutely right. And we've seen this for a long time. In my book, I talk about the Abercrombie ads that were there supposedly selling clothing to the teens that came into their stores, but these big portrayals of mostly naked teenagers were really objectifications of children and teens. And what I will point out on that is that parents complained. The adults who were walking the shopping malls complained. And when our culture sends a message to advertising agencies and to corporate America that the messaging is no longer appropriate and will not be tolerated, then companies will change their messaging. And so we all have a role to play here. It, even if it's a small one and it constitutes a call to a business or to a legislator, et cetera, we can all do something about this problem. And I applaud this radio station for doing its part and advancing the conversation with this show.
And briefly, Jennifer, as we wrap up, your message to maybe people in power to try to do something about this.
Right. They have to take it seriously in the sense that they do something about it. We need to change the laws in that we need to end this habit of or the practice of insisting on confidentiality provisions. If you want to insist on keeping the amount of a settlement confidential, fine, but the underlying facts should not be confidential. We also need to protect people who fall through the cracks of historic anti-discrimination laws, people who are not, for example, workers of the Weinstein Corporation, but who are independent consultants and contractors.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Jennifer Drobeck, professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment.